And in this case, under the proper standard, the board erred by disregarding a disclosure from the prior art Tata reference, an examined, issued, and corrected United States patent. Everyone agrees that the lens from Tata's Embodiment 3, based on data from Tata's Table 5, both works as a functional, albeit imperfect, lens and practices the three-zone limitation of the 990 patent. The board nonetheless disregarded Tata's teaching of the three-zone limitation. It did so because the board said Tata's disclosure of the three-zone limitation was a mistake.
Counsel, you cited to spelling errors in some of your briefing regarding examples of apparent errors. Are you asserting that spelling errors are the only types of error that would constitute an apparent error?
I wouldn't say that, Your Honor. The standard comes directly from Yale as well as from principles of patent law. And the standard is just, I guess, turning to Yale first. I think that that's obviously the seminal case that the briefing focused on. And that case really focused on the fact of the perspective of a skilled artisan and how they would read it. So if it were a spelling error that a skilled artisan would take to mean something, then that error would be credited as a disclosure. But if it's something that a skilled artisan would immediately recognize and disregard, correct, in their mind as a typo, that's the standard. So we're looking at it from the perspective of a skilled artisan, and we're looking at how they would view the error.
So from the perspective of skilled artisan, why wouldn't there be an apparent error here where it's, particularly looking from the perspective of a skilled artisan, the information, I think it's in Table 5, doesn't correlate to the information in Table 9. So why wouldn't a skilled artisan see that there's an error there?
So there's no record evidence indicating a skilled artisan had ever identified the error by just comparing it to Table 9.
So you would say you'd have to have actual evidence that a skilled artisan finds it in order to satisfy the standard?
I'm not saying that that's a requirement. However, if you look at the facts of this case here, the board came to the conclusion that, oh, you could compare tables as you referenced or look at the Japanese priority application based on hindsight. The only way that skilled artisans have uncovered the error was from Mr. Akins. And Mr. Akins took up to 12 hours to uncover that error. And what's really key in Yale is that it says that a skilled artisan would not even be led to think about building whatever the disclosure is. Mr. Akins clearly looked at the disclosure here, and he was led to build and model the lens, as did Dr. Chipman.
Wasn't he doing some other things? I mean, isn't that 12 hours somewhat disingenuous in terms of the amount of time that it takes?
So it's true that he was, according to his testimony, reviewing exactly what Dr. Chipman did and sort of following those procedures. But the fact remains that he still has at least the skill of an ordinary artisan, and he reviewed Tata and didn't immediately recognize the error when he reviewed it. He then was led to reconstruct the computer model of the lens, and he only...
importing an immediate requirement. What's your basis for saying it needs to have that sort of temporal aspect for this apparent error analysis?
Yes, that comes directly from Yale on 434F2D669, where the court focuses on the fact that both the court and skilled artisans would immediately note the inconsistency. And there's an important principle of patent law that that's based on beyond Yale. And it's the idea that you cannot claim a patent, which is a monopoly, on inventions that are already in the public possession. The public already has notice of the invention. So the immediately disregard or correct standard comes from that idea that if a skilled artisan would read it and not immediately say, oh, this is a typo.
What if it takes them 3 hours?
So obviously in this case it didn't. It took much longer, but I think the immediacy requirement requires perhaps less time than that. 3 hours would be a lot of analysis of a document to realize that there's an error.
Sometimes mathematical errors aren't seen apparent. They're not, you know, apparent on the face. It takes a little bit of work to figure it out, right? So the problem I'm having, I'm just going to tell you the concern I have about the rule you're advocating. It feels like a bright line rule where I'm supposed to figure out, because this is a factual question, and I'm supposed to determine whether substantial evidence supports the finding below. And you're suggesting that I should put a temporal limit on the amount of time it takes a POSA to identify the error. And I'm just having trouble with that because I really don't like bright line rules. I think that their rules are to be tailored for each specific situation. So why don't you tell me why it is that I should have a bright line rule, that it should be, I don't know, how much time, an hour, 10 minutes, 15 minutes? How much time should I give a POSA to figure out that there's an apparent error?
So I think it'll always be fact specific so that you don't have to make a bright line rule to rule in this case. And I'll also add that I'm not advocating for anything beyond what Yale already says, because Yale already includes a component of immediacy. So that
can we on Yale, just because I want to make sure I understand what you're saying, it says here. I pulled up Yale because you're talking about it, so I appreciate your discussion of that. But when I look to the word immediately, I didn't see it in the context of a POSA. It looked like it was in a different context. So can you at least point me to exactly where in Yale you're getting this immediacy requirement? I want to make sure I understand your argument.
Sure. So I believe I provided you the page site before, which was 669. And if you look at Yale then, it first begins by discussing whether the prior art places the compound in the possession of the public, once again underlying the policy principles in there. And then if we go on, it says, it goes on to say that the one we immediately noted was the inconsistency between figures 1 and figures 3 of Clements, which is the prior art article. So it notes that the court itself, which is not, I'll give it to you, a skilled artisan, but perhaps...
That's not stating what the test is, right? Mm-hmm. They say it cannot be said that one of ordinary skill in the art would do anything more than mentally disregard the error as a misprint or mentally substitute the correct information in its place. That's something they say. And they say that inconsistencies which make it apparent that there was an error. They don't say the test is whether it's immediately noted, right? They just say, after they say what the test is, they say, suffice it to say that the one we immediately noted was blah, blah, blah.
Well,
is the one bit of information that they immediately noted that would suggest that there was an error.
And in the next paragraph, they go on to say, we have no doubt that the chemist of ordinary skill in the art would readily recognize. So I'll give it to you that they don't use the word immediately in that line, but readily has a sense of a temporal aspect to it. And that is our interpretation of Yale. And it makes sense from a policy perspective to interpret Yale narrowly, to only allow mistakes which are part of the public domain, that the public has been noticed on. In this case, it's an issued patent that that Mr. Tata didn't notice the error, his prosecuting attorneys didn't notice the error, the patent office examiner didn't notice the error, the corrections branch, when they corrected other errors in the patent, didn't notice the error, and LGE's expert, Dr. Chipman, who himself is a skilled artisan, was led from the data in this document to then construct a model based on that table.
Do you have any other case besides Yale that imports some type of temporal standard or immediacy requirement?
The cases do not have a lot of analysis other than Yale. I would point you to In re Garfinkel, which is a case where the court did find that the error should not be disregarded. It doesn't have a discussion of immediacy, but it does note that despite the fact that there was a typographical error in that one, it wasn't something that would be readily apparent to a skilled artisan. And to be clear, we use the terms immediately disregard or correct as a paraphrase of the teachings of Yale and how it should be applied to this case. I also want to point out, as I was saying, as to who didn't recognize this error, Immervision filed a patent owner preliminary response in this case and did not recognize the error.
These arguments were all made to the fact finder below, right?
I believe so, yes.
And the fact finder below said, yeah, we hear you, but there's this other evidence that compels us to think there's an error here, right?
The fact finder did, but the board made fact findings based on an incorrect legal standard under Yale. The board found that a skilled artisan with the benefit of hindsight could find the error, by comparing the tables and looking at the priority
application. Can you show me, you're pointing out some language that where the board says, with the benefit of hindsight, we see there is an error?
That's our interpretation of it. If you look at appendix page 66, that's where the board uses the term obvious, but it's very much using that word, which obviously is used frequently in patent law, in a sort of general, could the skilled artisan eventually uncover the error? And I don't think there's any dispute that, yes, it could. But this should be a narrow...
You agree there's an error at this point, right?
Absolutely.
It was a trans... I guess it was a copy and paste error.
Yeah, that is our guess. We do not have evidence from Tada himself saying where it came from, but it appears to have been copied.
The earlier Japanese patent that from which the U.S. application, I guess, was derived has information that was not properly copied into the table. Right?
That's the way that it appears. It was a patent application from Japan. It was not an issued patent, but yes. So going back to Yale for a moment, because I think if you look at Yale and juxtapose the error from Yale to that here, it really becomes clear that something that the error that was mentioned in Yale is something that a skilled artisan would disregard, wouldn't consider, whereas there is disclosure here. Yale involved the prior arts Clements article, which had well-known compounds for making an anesthetic compound. One of them was CF3-CHCl-Br. It was in its text. It was in Figure 1, and it was a known compound. It was
Can
something...
Can I go back? I just want to go back, because we've read Yale.
Yeah.
I understand what your point is here. I have a question on page A66, going back to it. It's the particular language that you're relying on for saying that the board was relying on hindsight is... The one that says the particular manner in which Mr. Aikens determined that there was an error in Table 5 is laid out in patent owner's response does not diminish that there is an obvious error in Tada within the meaning of Yale. That's the sentence you're relying on? Is that correct? I just want to make sure I understand.
Sorry, I'm just looking for where on the page the line... Oh, I see where it is, that last paragraph. That is part of it, and also if you go up to the line that begins the relevant question, which is about halfway down the page, the relevant question is whether the error was an obvious error to one of ordinary skill in the art, not whether Mr. Aikens happened to take a circuitous route to determine that the spherical data in Table 5 was in fact the error. And then it goes on to give its findings. The board is very much using obvious error here, because it's clear that Mr. Aikens Only by hindsight, that's the only way that anybody has ever been able to come to a quick solution to find this error.
What if, like, Mr. Aiken, you know, he's not going to think there's an error. It might have taken some work to figure out there was an error because, you know, it's not often that patents have this kind of error in it, right?
I would agree with that, and that's why we should lean towards disclosure. This table's been in the prior art for 20 years. Even basically finding that this wouldn't be an error would prevent even Mr. Tada from practicing literally what he disclosed in his own patent.
The concern I'm having about your rule that you're proposing is that I'm supposed to look at how the error was observed. I'm not supposed to look at the quality of the error. I'm only supposed to look at how it was actually finally determined. And that I'm supposed to judge that and determine whether how much time it took, how much effort it took in deciding whether something's an error under NRA Yale or not.
So how it was actually found is not dispositive. I think it's just relevant to the inquiry. Just as in Yale, they commented that the error was found by skilled artisans who wrote to the editor and the writer wrote back. So it's clearly relevant to the inquiry, but how it was actually uncovered is not the inquiry. What you're supposed to do from Yale is look at the reference from the perspective of a skilled artisan and say, how would a skilled artisan view this error? Would they view it as a disclosure? Or would they immediately recognize, disregard, or correct that error? And that's the question here. And that didn't happen here. The evidence is clear that everyone who looked at this until many hours were spent didn't disregard that reference. So to take it
put
away.
That immediately back in there. The question is whether they would recognize that there's an error, an immediate error.
They eventually recognized the error, but it took them a lot of time. And the key language in Yale, again, is you wouldn't be led to build it. There's no doubt that the skilled artisans here who reviewed it were led to build it. So I see I've used my rebuttal time. I'm happy to answer more questions or reserve what I have left. Thank you.
Well, are you also, one more question.
Yes.
Are you also arguing at all that, let's say that depending on the observer, it would take more or less time for the error to be captured, that this controls in the entirety whether the entire title reference is discarded or whether anything else in that reference should continue to be relevant in the overall review of the invention.
So I didn't read the board's opinion as disregarding Tada's disclosure as a whole. In fact, it analyzed other aspects of Tada. So I don't think the court needs to go that far here. The key issue is just whether or not you need to disregard the disclosure from Table 5. So that's not really an issue that's before the court that the court needs to consider. But I think I would agree with the board that the rest of the disclosure is still valid to a skilled artisan.
Okay, we'll save your rebuttal. Let's hear from the other side.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court.
Hold on until we remove the screen. We can't see you. There you are. And they will move the device to the center of the court. And Mr. Simmons, now please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'd like to address what counsel said about Mr. Aiken spending 10 to 12 hours. We disagree with that. Mr. Aikens did not set out to find an error. In fact, at Appendix 2339 to 2425, he talks about what he was doing was repeating what Dr. Chitman did. Dr. Chitman only modeled embodiment 3. And he did so to find the three-zone limitation because in Tada, it never mentioned expansion, compression, expansion. That's the three-zone limitation. You had to model that embodiment 3 to meet the claim limitations of the patent at issue, which is the 990 patent. So Mr. Aikens repeated what he did. He didn't say he read the whole patent from the beginning. He said he repeated what Dr. Chitman did. When he did so, he found that the lens didn't work. He said, well, I must have done something wrong. So if you go to page 2425, he said, excuse me, let me find the exact quote. And this is in response to a question from petitioner during his deposition. Mr. Aikens testified that when I was typing in embodiment 2 from table 3, the aspheric coefficients were exactly the same as table 5. That's never true. So the person of ordinary skill in the art just looked at table 2 or table 3 and table 5 and said, that can't be right. Then he knew the aspheric shift was correct. So it wasn't 10 to 12 hours. It was only when he went back from the beginning to the reference that he identified the issue. An additional thing that he found is that when you look at table 5, the number should match table 9. So he said in his testimony to appendix 2427, because the focal length is 1, table 9 rather conveniently gives you the aspheric coefficients 3 for the 4 embodiments. And it matches correctly for 1, 2, and 4, and it's totally wrong for 3. So then he went and got the Japanese priority application, which is incorporated by reference in Tada. LG hasn't disputed it. Their expert didn't address it. The Japanese priority application has a table 5 in it. Mr. Aikens testified that he could read the numbers in table 5 of the Japanese application and compare them to table 5 of the U.S. version of Tada, and it didn't match. So let's talk about what LG admits. LG doesn't dispute that there's an error in Tada. In fact, LG admits there's an error in Tada's table 5. At Blue Brief, page 15, it says, LG does not deny that there's an error in Tada's table 5. Further, there's no dispute that if a lens was constructed using the correct aspherical data from Tada's Japanese priority application, the lens would not satisfy the three-zone limitation. This all comes from the intrinsic record and supports the PTAB's final written decision. Now, let's go back to the difference between Yale and Garfinkel. And I want to read from Yale because we're talking about how long did it take. And we agree there should not be a temporal limitation. The real issue is whether you can discern the error from the intrinsic record or if you have to go to the extrinsic record. In Yale, at that same passage, if you read the beginning part of it, it said, appellant has gone through a detailed review. These are the words from Yale. A detailed review of the Clements article to point out the inconsistencies, plural, which make it apparent that the typographical compound error is an error. any number of these individually or cumulatively, we believe, would alert one of ordinary skill in the art to the existence of a typographical error. Suffice it to say, the one we immediately noted was that the inconsistencies between figs 1 and 3 of Clements. So they compared two tables after they were alerted to it by one of ordinary skill in the art, who went through a detailed review. That doesn't sound like immediate.
Counsel, how do you interpret the phrase mentally disregard in Yale?
Immediately disregard.
Mentally disregard. I just wanted to be accurate.
Mentally disregard. So once Mr. Akins, for example, saw that the values in Table 5 made a bad lens, Mr. Akins, one of ordinary skill in the art, wouldn't make it. That's why he went back and looked for what the real numbers were. So mentally disregard is, why would I use it if it's not right? The same thing happened in Yale. Somebody looked at the compound. They wouldn't have recognized that the compound was a typo if they only looked at figure 3. It's when they went back to figure 1 and saw that the compound without the typo was there. And then they saw that the log P of F, I think it is, the log values were the same for the typo compound and for the correct compound, which also should never happen. Just like the aspherical values in tables 3 and 5 in Tata should never match. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
That's fine. Go ahead.
Okay. So with respect to Garfinkel, before I forget, in Garfinkel, the difference between Yale and Garfinkel is in Garfinkel there was nothing to let somebody know that there was an error. There wasn't an inconsistency in the reference. What happened was they submitted a declaration from a third party that said, oh, this wasn't, I believe Garfinkel's the 5.12% aluminum oxide. It was only 2%. But that wasn't information from within the reference. So they found that the reference that was used in Garfinkel put the public on notice that this could be the glass that has this percentage. The same thing with In re Clark, which was a Fed Circuit case. In In re Clark, the reference disclosed an FM transmitter. There was nothing within the four corners of the reference or in the disclosure within the reference that would tell you there wasn't an FM transmitter. They also submitted a secondary affidavit that said there actually wasn't an FM transmitter in that prior device. So they said that's not an obvious error.
How do you respond to the argument that there should be some sort of temporal in component to this test, with the idea being that, you know, if the error is not able to be determined fairly quickly, it must not be an obvious error of the type that Opposa would cause a deposer to mentally disregard the errant disclosure?
I think the issue is not how long it takes. We agree there should not be a temporal limitation. It should be readily... The real issue is whether you can tell the error from the intrinsic disclosure of the reference or not. So if the error is readily apparent from the intrinsic disclosure within the reference itself, that's an obvious error. If it's not, and you have to turn to extrinsic evidence, that would not be an obvious error.
So I think your adversary argues it's not readily apparent here because otherwise it wouldn't have taken so much time to determine that there was in fact an error. Do you think that should be something legal issue? I understand you've already said that you don't agree with that.
Right.
I understand that argument. I'm just asking as a legal matter, what do you think of that test?
I don't think that test can work. I mean, it's impossible to decide. The references are of different lengths and different complexities, and it depends whether you can see by comparing two tables. Like in our case, I think it really doesn't take that long, as the board found. Or the panel found, where you could see table 3 and table 5 were identical, that's a problem. You could see table 5 and table 9 didn't match, that's a problem. That's readily apparent. But if you put a time limit on, let's go to a more complex case like the one in Clark, where we were talking about nuclear transmitters. The references were long. Yeah, so how long does it take to actually read the overall reference and start comparing the charts? I think that's an impossible black line to put on a test.
So the question really should be whether Opposa thinks there's an obvious error from the face of the patent itself.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. That answer your question?
Yes.
Unless the panel has any further questions, I have nothing more.
No more questions? All right. Thank you. Ms. Goldenberg.
Thank you, Your Honor. The standard that opposing counsel is promoting is one that just doesn't make sense, especially when you look at this case, because the numbers here were within range. You compare the other cases where the numbers were just blatantly out of range or the compound was entirely unknown when it was an article about known compounds. That's something that APOSA, who was reading it, would readily recognize. It would be apparent. They would immediately disregard it as if the disclosure wasn't even there. Here, these numbers were...
I don't even know if that's true, to be honest with you. I mean, I'm just going to press on this fact finder point. I'm not a POSA. Shouldn't I be looking at and deferring to the finding of fact of the board below on this issue and others about whether something would be an apparent obvious error to a person of ordinary skill in the art? As an electrical engineer, I surely don't know whether Yale was an obvious error or not.
Well, you can certainly defer to fact finding as you should, but once again, in this case, the board used the four corners intrinsic standard that my opponent is promoting here. And that's not what Yale says. He's saying, oh, you can put these numbers into a model and you'll see something's wrong. And that's the opposite of Yale. Yale says, do not build it. If you were even led to build it to realize there's a mistake, then you haven't satisfied the standard.
Does the board also say, and didn't the board also say, you can tell the errors apparent by comparing the tables? Oh, nobody would have the same figure numbers for the embodiment in Table 3 compared to the embodiment in Table 5. That he didn't recognize that before doesn't mean that it wasn't apparent.
Well, of course, that was with hindsight. But as well, the board was still using the incorrect standard. The board was using the standard of four corners of the reference, the intrinsic evidence standard, which is not what Yale says. And there are principles of patent law behind the standard that I'm advocating that I think are absent from the standard that Immervision is advocating. It's pretty dramatic. It's pretty drastic to take away something that's been disclosed to the public. And that's exactly what he's advocating, to say that the public cannot rely on an issued and expired patent. It can't even practice that anymore because there was a mistake, and it was a mistake that it took a skilled artisan many hours to find when many other artisans and lawyers and other people who looked at this reference didn't realize that mistake. There are patent policy issues behind that would counsel against such a rule. And his rule is actually the bright line clear rule, because this rule allows flexibility from the perspective of a skilled artisan. And it allows the board to make those fact findings with every single reference. Unless the court has any other questions. All right, well, thank you.
Okay. All right, our thanks to counsel. The case is taken under submission.